The AD&D 1st Edition Barbarian Gun Rage, an ability that didn't appear until D&D 3rd Edition. Dragon Magazine number 133 did introduce a 1st Edition Berserker class meant for NPCs. These Berserkers had a rage feature similar to what we now think of for Barbarians, except that the Berserker couldn't stop raging early, meaning that they might stop walloping their allies. The Berserker also couldn't enter a rage voluntarily, but had a percentage chance to rage in stressful situations. I bet they turned a bit green, too, because you certainly wouldn't like them when they're angry.
And now we present to you Thacko with Advantage.
Welcome to Thacko with Advantage. We're two friends that have been playing D&D a long time. While we both love lots of other RPGs, D&D is the crucible that trained us in the tabletop RPG disciplines. Hi, I'm Ange. I've been gaming for over 35 years. In 2014, I started writing for Gnome Stew, and I've been running the Gnomecast, the Stew's podcast, since 2017. And around 2021, I kind of became head gnome. It was a battle to the not-quite-death, but there you go.
And I'm Jared, the review gnome at Gnome Stew. I've been gaming since roughly 1985. In addition to writing reviews at Gnome Stew, I've got my own site, whatdoinojr.com, where I write additional reviews and opinion pieces on a variety of RPGs. After we look at the games that we're running in the campaign journal, we'll be talking about martial character backstories. Then we'll have some recommendations of D&D-related content for you to check out in our downtime research segment.
So no City of Cows game this week, again, because of vacations and all of that. But I did get to play the misnamed Dungeon of the Mad Mage campaign. I suppose I should... I mean, it's not. Let's just be honest. I suppose I should call it what the GM named it on Shard, but that's in French. And I don't necessarily do well with French, so forgive me, I'm going to try. Singes de Guerre, which is French translating to war monkeys. This is a very deep in-joke from the group that from when we first started playing together back in 2004 or 2005. But, you know, that's what the campaign is called on Shard.
Just reminded me of Night Monkey in the second Spider-Man movie.
Yeah, it was such an in-joke that my very first Gen Con in 2006, Chessex was doing custom dice at the con, so I got a D6 made for everyone in the group that had on the number one side, the monkey will kill you. Anyway, this session started with us in Waterdeep on a break. An invitation came asking us to meet with somebody who had a job for us. It turned out to be a dwarf, whose name I have written down somewhere but didn't bother to look up for my notes here. He was asking us to break into his former business partner's vault and steal a family heirloom of his. And he said he had gotten our names from a mutual associate. We were, of course, a little hesitant, but did our research and checked things out with our mutual friend, and we ended up deciding to do the job. Now, I play Selena, who is a fighter. She is not about stealth and sneaky things. But that doesn't mean the job wasn't for the rest of the group. So her job ended up mostly being bringing up the things the other characters weren't thinking about. Like the fact that they kept forgetting that our payment for the job would be the other items we could steal, as they were all planning to make this a get-in, get-out quick, you know, heist.
Yeah.
And they kept forgetting that this guy is not going to pay us anything. Our payment is whatever else we can take from the vault. Also, Selena was against any plan that included indiscriminately killing any of the hired guards. She has the mercenary veteran background, so I figured she would look at this as these are just hired guards. They are not likely to be deathly loyal to this person. They're not evil. They are just people getting a paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not worth a death sentence. And of course, everyone's like, oh, yeah, fine. And then we have this whole long debate about what actually you can do as non-lethal damage in D&D. I don't remember how its rules is written in the actual book, but in Baldur's Gate 3, you can only do non-lethal damage with melee attacks.
Yes, I believe that is how it's written. You don't have to decide until you knock them to zero hit points whether you killed them or not, but it is with a melee attack.
Whereas with a ranged weapon or a spell, you don't have a choice. I found out the hard way in Baldur's Gate and was like, oh, okay, I'm going to reload and redo this because I did not want to kill these people. In the end, we put most of the party in the warlock's magical genie space. We had our rogue wonder reduced in size and invisible, carrying the, it's not a lamp, it's a ring, mm-hmm. but it still serves as his extra dimensional genie space.
Yeah.
Wonder was invisible and carrying it. Wonder scaled the wall, broke into the window, and in the chamber we broke into, turns out was an office bedchamber, and there just happened to be a young silver dragon taking a nap in there. So he was thankfully able to sneak past the dragon that woke up when he came in. And then we got into the main vault area, at which point Malcolm led us all out of the lamp. And Arima, our cleric of Mistra, cast a silence spell on a coin that was then given to me, Selena, to carry. We found two separate areas that were both locked and trapped. The easier one to get into had just gold. And then the other one had, I want to say, 8 different cases with various items in them, including the piece we were supposed to steal. We ended up having, I want to say, like, I'm just the muscle here. So I was mostly standing in place with the silenced ring to, like, make sure no one could hear what we were doing. But the plan was to have Arima cast Dispel Magic on all of the cases, because the cases were double trapped. Like, there was an outside trap and then an inside trap, and we could disable the outside trap with the silence spell, but the inside trap would basically send a message, so we had to dispel that. Able to get through all that, it used up pretty much all of Arima's higher level spells, except for one that was intended to be used for gate to get us out of there and to the Temple of Mistra. And I think Jared may know where this is going, because I think he's probably read this adventure, because the GM kept asking us, so that's your plan, right? You're just going to teleport out. And we're like, yeah, yeah, that's our plan. And he kept consulting his notes. And then when we got all the items, threw them in our bags of holding, and it came time to teleport out, and nothing. Spell just fizzled. Turns out the entire building is warded against teleporting in or out. So that's where we ended the session. And next time we're going to figure out if we can still get through this without a fight.
I am assuming that since you have the person with the genie lamp, you have a warlock that has the genie pact.
Yes.
I like that one. That one's kind of cool.
Yeah, it's turning out to be pretty cool. I mean, I had no idea he had this extra dimensional space. It was like, this is nice. Why the hell are we not camping in here? It's like, he's like, well, because I'd have to leave the ring on the ground outside. Like, okay, fair enough. But still, this is more comfortable than the ground.
Should at least use this once in a while. All right. Our usual Thursday night game did not happen last week because one of our players had another obligation. But we did game. We tried out the Dragonbane RPG. I won't go into too many details on that session here, but I think it's worth pointing out that it's kind of a good thing to play other fantasy RPGs and to get an idea of what they do that D&D doesn't, and what way you prefer either direction, and to recharge your batteries.
Absolutely.
I'm not giving up D&D anytime soon, but it was fun and it was neat seeing how Dragonbane does some things.
I've had this conversation a lot over the years because there are times where, much as I love it, I get tired of D&D.
Mm-hmm.
It tends to be the default game for a lot of groups, and sometimes it's just, I want to play something different. But I have found that when I go play a different fantasy game that uses completely different mechanics, even if I enjoy it in the moment, eventually I start being like, I think I'd rather just do this in D&D. I've offended many, many people because I say this about Dungeon World, which there are a bunch of folks in my circle who are like, Dungeon World is the best. And I'm just like, yeah, but if I was going to do this long term, I'd just rather play D&D.
Yeah. And I did.
It's still good to get those experiences, though.
Yeah, I tried using Dungeon World as a vent for one of my D&D groups, and it did not click with them very well. So,
yeah.
So we did manage to get the monthly game that has been on hiatus for 6 months up and running again. We were short one player She couldn't make it, so our ranger spent most of the session going out and scouting in the wilderness, and it worked. That's a good narrative. You can have your ranger out wandering. That's fine.
Yeah.
I still let them benefit from her you can't get lost in the forest for the first 3 days of their travel to where they were going. It is funny because we're still doing that thing where, because they haven't played a lot, they're still kind of excited every day when I'm like, okay, roll to see if you get lost. Other people are at that phase where they've done this for so many times, they're ready to hand wave it. And they're like, every little thing, it's like, okay, how many rations do we need to eat? So that's fun. The party is going to recruit some orcs because there's a big issue right now between a green dragon and her hobgoblin mercenaries and an undead general and all of the spirits that he's pulling from the Shadowfell and their area that is overseen by the druid circle is getting overrun by both of these forces. So they got sent out to look for some other allies. They already recruited some Shadar Kai. So next up, they're going to go recruit some orcs. While they were traveling, we had an issue where they had two encounters in a row that were plant monsters. I could have fudged it, but at the same time, this is weird, but I am trying to give them that feel of, you know, sometimes dumb things come up two encounters in a row. The nice thing was the second one is it's a Groff that I believe is in the Strixhaven book, and it's almost like a big dog, except it's made out of plants. So when they got that to bloodied, once it was at 50% of its hit points, I just had it leave because this is like an animal intelligence thing that's looking for food. It's not going to sit there and fight to the death. And, you know, it's like, these things fight back. I'm going to go find some other meal. The other thing that they ran into was one of the blights that is all thorny, and I cannot remember the name of it, and I am terrible right now. But those are vulnerable to fire, and they are also intelligent and specifically evil. So this one was not retreating. This one definitely wanted to kill them.
Those are a pain in the butt in Baldur's Gate 3.
Our druid had the idea that since it is vulnerable to fire, she wanted to use heat metal to help our paladin do extra damage. And I didn't want to dissuade her from the idea that usually heat metal is like something you make your enemies, you know, drop their weapons with or boil them in their own armor. So I was like, it's fine. I will let you do the extra heat damage from having heat metal on the sword, but the paladin is going to take the damage from heat metal and she's going to have to save to, you know, hang on to the sword. It worked great. She ended up hitting it really, really hard and it was vulnerable. So that was like 48. Fire damage from the heat metal. They were all excited and they didn't mind at all that the dragonborn scorched her hand trying to do this. It helped that the dragonborn is a gold dragonborn, so it didn't scorch her quite as much as it would someone else, but they were just very happy about that unorthodox application of a spell. So it was like, I like this. This is cool. This is why I like running for people that haven't played a whole lot. They got to the two different camps of orcs. One of them was dedicated to Melora, the goddess of nature, and the other one was dedicated to Grummish, who is the traditional orc god of destruction and all of that. The way I have this set up is all the orcs in this region owe fealty to, like, a greater chieftain. So the Grummish worshipping orcs are not just on their own, they're still allied to these other tribes. But because they have been humiliated and upset with fighting the hobgoblins, they have decided that they are going to take over. They're going to challenge for leadership of all the orc tribes because they just want to rally around and wipe out the hobgoblins. They made some religion checks, so they kind of had an idea of what the Melora practices are versus Grummish's practices. And for whatever reason, they still decided to try and reason with the Grummish worshipping orcs first. What was even funnier was they get to the camp and they see the leader of the Grummish worshipping orcs giving this big speech to all of his people, rallying them, basically saying that, you know what, even if we don't win this challenge and take over, we are still going to murder the old leader and take her place one way or the other. For some reason, our monk, played by my daughter, decided to step out and start talking to them. Our monk does not have a high charisma score. It's so funny because she gets like halfway through that and I was like, all right, roll me a persuasion check to see how you did there. And she goes, oh, I am not good at this. Why did I do this?
Yeah, that's one of those things that I actually wrote an article about this on the Sioux where you have to Some people end up always playing the face character because other people don't want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard because you don't want to ignore the mechanics, but at the same time, you want to have... I don't know. What did you end up doing for her? I would have given her... If she gave a good speech, I probably would have given her advantage on the charisma roll.
It wasn't really a good speech. It was... It was just basically she was trying to tell them, you know, we're looking for allies and we'll give you honor in battle if you follow us and all of this. And it wasn't a bad speech, but it also wasn't great because she was basically trying to tell them, we'll rally you and then we can attack the undead hordes too on top of the hobgoblins. These orcs are going, I don't really want to fight undead. So our dragonborn paladin stepped in. I, you know, basically let them know the crowd is definitely turning against you here. You intruded on their camp here. You heard everything he was saying. This is not going to go well for you. The Dragonborn Paladin kind of stepped in and tried to do the intimidation check, basically saying that, you know, we need to band together. You're going to die if this, you know, if you don't, you know, realize that this is bigger than your concerns. And I already decided the leader of these orcs is not going to change his mind about how he needs to squash all these people that walked into his camp. But I also had a bunch of NPCs set up for this challenge that's going to happen later. And one of them is an orc storyteller that was in the camp. And since the paladin rolled really well with her charisma check, I had the storyteller basically intercede and say, you know, we are supposed to live by these traditions and it's wrong that we're planning this. You should let them live because they're just pointing out your failures for trying to be a coward. They managed to leave and go to the other camp. They arrived at the other camp and they spoke to the priestess of Melora that is in charge of all of the orcs in this region. They warned her that, you know, they're going to challenge you in this formal challenge, but if they don't win the formal challenge, they're just going to murder you. And she was like, that's fine. We're still going to do the formal challenge the way it's supposed to be done. You're welcome to stay in here. In fact, I will let you be champions for the Druid Circle. So if you win, you can help decide what direction we're going to go. So they're all excited about that. And she assigns them an orc bard to show them around the camp. Now, at this point, my daughter's monk has been collecting love interests everywhere that they go. And she still has a large, brawny Shadar Kai woman waiting for her in the Shadowfell. This time, she decided to flirt with the orc bard, and his name is Disaster, but it is spelled D-Z-A-S-T-I-R, and they loved that.
Well, I mean, she is kind of proving to be a bisexual disaster.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So, the Dragonborn Paladin, who is always competitive, is also trying to catch his eye. So she was saying things like, how do you feel about scales? And we concluded after they found out that, you know, the challenge is basically going to be a survival run through the woods. They're going to have another part of this where they're standing on logs trying to shove each other off. And then the final part of this is going to be a storytelling competition. So we've set the stage. Everybody knows what they're supposed to be there for. Everybody said, boy, I hope the ranger's here to do that wilderness run because all of us are going to suck at it. And that's where we left the session off.
Well, hopefully the ranger's player can make it next time.
Welcome to the Dungeon Master's Workshop.
In the Dungeon Master's Workshop. In previous episode, we've talked about the questions you want to ask regarding the nature of divine and arcane magic to better flesh out your setting and your characters. Because of how detailed those conversations can get, it's easy to assume you don't need that level of detail for martial characters, but how fighters, barbarians, monks, and rogues fit into the world can make the setting and the backstories of those characters more interesting and give everyone more to work with in the campaign. Let's start more broadly with the setting itself. Have there been any wars or conflicts in your setting where characters with martial abilities would have served?
Yeah, see, I like this because in at least a couple of the established D&D settings, you do have that. Like, I believe you've talked about this before when you were running in Eberron. You had characters that all served in the same unit during the last war.
Oh, yeah. In the Eberron setting, I believe, I don't remember if they updated it for 5th edition, but in the original publication of the book, the last war ended 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they kept the same time frame.
This is still a war-torn land where the peace is very tenuous between the different nations, between different people, and, you know, there's an entire war zone. You know, there's a lot to dig into there with the last war. I mean, of course, it's Eberron, so, oh yeah, I don't really want to do anything with the war, so we're just going to go over here and do this stuff. But it still provides a great backdrop for a variety of characters.
So do you have any other setting-specific wars that you can remember coming up?
So I'm not sure how this is handled in a lot of the adventures set in the Forgotten Realms, but the war against Tiamat was a pretty big thing in that adventure series, and that's something that should be in the background for other campaigns following that.
What's kind of interesting to me about that is I think the Tyranny of Dragons is like the only storyline that really gets kind of a sequel, because Storm King's Thunder boils out of those events. So it's kind of interesting that those two things kind of, like, you know, chain off of each other. I also know, like, it's weird. This is one of the things that I kind of wished that the Sword Coast Adventurer's Guide went into a little bit more, because it was a little thin on some setting details that I would have liked. But there's all sorts of wars around the Forgotten Realms, even in the 5th edition era. You had Sembia, that was still a vassal state to the City of Shade, attacking Cormyr. And that's a major war. It just didn't happen to happen where any of the adventures are set in 5th edition.
Yeah. Like, pretty much most of the adventures are Sword Coast.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, it's an area rich with material for adventures, but then there's this whole other part.
Oh, yeah.
Of the world.
And obviously, if you're playing in Dragonlance, you've got a built-in war there. Depending, I mean, if you play the 5th edition adventure, the War of the Lance is just now kind of hitting your character. So you may not have that same veteran background that you could have in other eras in Dragonlance, but it is a thing if you want to advance your timeline to where Dragonlance has definitely been in the past and have people as veterans of the War of the Lance. That's a thing you can do.
You know, if you're doing your own homebrew setting, this is definitely a thing you can work in there, especially if you want to have tension between two governing bodies of various areas. And I mean, there's always, you know, it's a bit of a tired trope, but it's the, you know, the horde of barbarians going to come and invade. And that's war-torn stuff that could affect your campaign and provide an opportunity for some of these martial characters to build up their backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
What does having a major conflict in the history of the game give you and your players to work with?
Well, right off the bat, when we started talking about Eberron and wars, I was thinking the story of why a war ended can be very important.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I kind of brushed up against it when I said war zones, but the Mornland is so much more than a war zone.
Yeah, and it is really neat because that is kind of this built-in, like, reason that a lot of people do not want to ever see another war on the continent again, because that was devastating.
Yeah, somebody took the nuclear option. Nobody knows exactly what happened, but it was taken, and an entire country was wiped off the face of the map. Literally. The land is still there, but it is not the same.
Yeah. Just talking about Dragonlance, that's another interesting thing, because the War of the Lance ended because they banished Takhesus back to the Abyss, but the dragon armies didn't go away. There was actually a treaty saying, okay, dragon armies, you get to stay in this territory here and don't cause any problems, which is going to, oddly, cause problems because they're not gone. They are still there. There is still tension there. So it is important to think about those things, like, if your characters are decent people, they probably aren't going to wipe out every last person in an opposing army.
No.
You have to realize what's going to happen afterwards. What kind of relationships are you going to have between these different regions once that war is over?
Yeah. It's very rare for a nation state, city state, whatever you want to call it in your setting, to get completely subsumed by the victor of a war. If there's a peace treaty, there's still going to be tension between the governing factions of those areas. If they didn't sign a peace treaty and are just occupying it, there's going to be rebels. There's going to be people that are trying to fight back.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, this could go in either direction. This could be you're on the side of the people trying to rebel and force out the occupying force, or you're the force that came in and now you're trying to keep the people safe that aren't fighting back because there's danger to them from people just trying to cause havoc and damage.
That's been kind of interesting with the inter-party thing there in the Moraya campaign, because the Dragon Empire occupied Moraya. This was not always part of the Dragon Empire. This is within the last 50 years that this happened. Jeremiah's character has a much different perspective on we brought enlightenment to all of these people versus no, these people are not happy.
You're not, you know, like the people we're working with aren't horrible, but Yrazazah seems to be an upstanding dragon, but the occupation has not been kind to the people who've been living here since before the dragons came.
And a lot of that is just she's trying to keep worse dragons from being in charge in that region.
Moving on to our classes, the fighter has been a mainstay in D&D since the very beginning, and the fighting man. Are there any formal options in your setting where fighters can learn their trade?
I've always kind of liked this idea that there are established militaries. I know a lot of people kind of roll with the idea that fighters are kind of a default, but I do like this idea that fighters are not just characters that have hit points and are strong.
I mean, they're that too.
They are that too. But especially like if you compare them to what barbarians know, for example, they know techniques. They know, like, they are formally trained. So I like the idea that, you know, you could have mercenary companies that might have trained people formally. There is actually, like, you know, militaries where you could have served in this or that country's, you know, military. Dueling academies was another one that I really like, because it is that kind of that idea that you're a noble and you're supposed to never need to do this, but, you know, your family still thinks it would be neat if you knew how to duel someone with a rapier, so they pay for you to have a tutor.
I mean, there's a lot of, you know, the fighter is a very broad canvas on which you can hang a whole variety of backstories.
Mm-hmm.
Selena, she grew up the daughter of merchants. Her grandmother runs an inn, and she just wasn't happy. She joined a mercenary company. Everything she knows, she gained through serving with that mercenary company, hence the mercenary veteran background.
Mm-hmm.
And it flavors a lot of who she is. You could be the noble child who learned through tutors and academies and all of that, and just are very good at your skills. You could be somebody who served in a knight's militia. There's a whole variety of how you could have gotten your skills as a fighter. And it's worth thinking about. Is there an organization you were part of back in the day?
This actually kind of plays into something that you might associate with another class in Wushu stories. There are, like, these rivalries between different schools of fighting, and you can bring that into a fighter as well, because you could have this one duelist that is, you know, known for teaching this style, and then another duelist who's teaching these other fighters, and you're not supposed to get along because these are competing schools.
So when someone wants to be a self-trained as a fighter and they don't want to, you know, involve any sort of organized training, what can you do to add to that background to still have a rich story?
I think, like, for one thing, there's always the default that somebody in your family knows these skills and they pass them down to you.
There's the, I have inherited my father's sword and I have picked it up to go in his place. I mean, hey, Mulan.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I know I'm going to reference it again later, but my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die.
Prepare to die. Oh, my God. I was watching something recently and it was talking about Princess Bride, and one of the guys kept trying to do Inigo Montoya, and he's like, I'm sorry, I'm just being Antonio Banderas doing Puss in Boots.
Another duelist archetype.
Yes.
You can have people that are self-trained that have grown up, like, in a war-torn area and just watched a lot mm-hmm. of other people and pick things up from, you know, just being in an area where a lot of people need to know how to fight.
your small town defender.
Mm-hmm.
Although I will say, having just played through a short Highlander campaign, there is always value to having a mentor, that somebody you can say trained you.
Oh, yeah. I love PCs having somebody to be able to look back on that and say, this is the person that trained me and maybe instilled my values in me. And maybe if they don't hold up those values that they instilled in me, I now feel upset because they aren't living up to the thing that they told me was important. That's a whole thing.
Oh, yeah. Whole thing. So we think of fighters as being very basic, but what does it add when you pick a subclass that has magic or other special abilities? Now, this is to caveat on this. There is nothing basic about any of the fighter subclasses, even the champion, which is probably the easiest to handle for a new player. But when you're adding in things like magic and psionics mm-hmm. and that type of thing, how do we work that into the story of the character?
Well, one of the things that I think is interesting is that on one hand, if you have this spellcasting thing, you could have flavored that as this is somebody that grew up with these powers and they're just learning how to use it just on a different level than a sorcerer, except our one spellcasting, you know, our arcane spellcasting subclass is an intelligence caster, which implies you are learning spells and studying and learning these things from books. So that kind of implies that if you are going to be an Eldritch Knight, you are learning a formal tradition from someone and how to cast these spells.
In some ways, I think of the Eldritch Knight as almost the opposite side of the coin to the Bladesinger.
Because mm-hmm.
the Bladesinger is a wizard who fights with a sword.
Yeah.
So their focus is on their spells, but they're still a beast in combat. Whereas the fighter is the opposite side, where they're a beast in combat, but they also do the spells.
Yeah, and I think it's probably a good subclass. You know, we're already talking about serving in certain countries' militaries, but if you have a country in your setting that is very magic oriented, maybe the wizards are in charge of that setting, this is actually a good representation of what maybe a knight would be like in that sort of setting, because they're going to expect you to know at least the basics of using magic, even if you are a fighter, if you are someone important and a knight or whatever in the in that country.
You could even do something like the Eldritch Knight is someone who comes from a formal wizarding school who channeled this character into these martial mm-hmm. abilities because they felt they weren't going to be able to cut the higher levels
yeah.
of magic and casting spells, but they could be a great meat shield with their spells for the rest of the wizards. There's a lot of arrogance in wizards.
Every time I look at a wish spell, I get a migraine, so I am not going to become a high-level wizard. Speaking, though, of people that are born with an ability, I think that's one thing that you can do with the Psy Warrior, though.
Mm-hmm.
You can have somebody that has those psychic abilities and just kind of learned how to tweak those abilities along with their fighting style and, you know, owns it in that way.
You have to deal with the fact that you don't get your subclass until third level with a fighter. We'll touch on that when we get to rogues.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But yeah, it is kind of weird, but you can at least roll with that idea that you always had these powers. You just weren't good at incorporating them into your fighting style until that point in time. Or you could just have a crazy wizard from the desert take you off planet to blow up a large battle station, because we know the Psy Warrior is basically a Jedi.
Fighters, along with rangers and paladins, choose a fighting style when they create their characters. Are there ways to tie these choices to fun inter-universe names for the various styles, since we've already mentioned Princess Bride?
Yeah, I mean, that is one of my favorite scenes in The Princess Bride, when Inigo and Wesley are dueling each other and they're throwing back, oh, I see you're using Bonadetti's defense, but that is, you know, no good against Capoferro. Yes, I see that you have studied your Agrippa. I love all of that because it implies that fighting isn't something for someone that is unsophisticated. It is very much showing that these are skilled individuals that have done studying and training and understand like this philosophy of combat. And you can do something like that. If somebody takes the great weapon style, you could come up with a name for somebody that was famous that, you know, used the great weapon style. And in this one country, this is always named after that person. And you can use that to add some detail to your character. And it may not be called that in another country because somebody else originated the style.
There is definitely an art to fighting. And it's very easy to just assume that it's the big dumb fighter swinging his sword. It can be more than that. And this is no shade against anyone who wants to play the big dumb fighter swinging his sword or her sword.
But I think what's interesting in all that, too, is you see this in a lot of stories like that where someone is presented as kind of being the not the brightest member of the party. They're just here to hit things. But almost all of those characters long term, there's going to be that moment when somebody talks to them and you realize they are deeper than what they appear to be. And that's that thing where you understand everybody has some form of intelligence, not necessarily the ability score intelligence, but what real actual intelligence to understand their life skills and where they are better at certain things than other people are.
It doesn't need to be your dump stat.
Yeah.
Speaking of int as a dump stat, let's move on to the fighter's angrier cousin, the barbarian. And I'm not saying barbarians need to have an int dump stat either, but because barbarians favor raw power and passion over precise technique, is there still room to talk about what training looks like for a barbarian?
I think, like, on a very basic level, I think, like, if a fighter looks at how a barbarian is holding their axe, they're going to think that maybe that barbarian is holding their axe a little sloppy, but they're still holding it the right way. So there is some level of training that goes on. Like, you don't just pick up an axe and know how to swing it in a fight without learning a few things about how an axe works.
A lot of times when I think of a barbarian, I think of learning through the school of hard knocks. There is that anger that's in them that they channel into their abilities, but at the same time, they've learned because they had to.
And I even picture, like, if you're going to train to become a barbarian, to, you know, grip onto this passion and use it in your fighting style, these are the kind of people where it's like, you know, somebody might make you stand in a cold lake for an hour and, you know, freeze your butt off. And that's teaching you this endurance and how to tap into this anger because you're just sitting there seething because you're getting colder and colder. That's the kind of training I can picture for a barbarian. So it's not like precise techniques, but there are still processes that you could add into your backstory that show that it's not just, I woke up one day and I was really mad and I hit somebody with a club and now I'm a barbarian.
Now, barbarians have been around for quite some time, but their history with the game has changed quite a bit. Originally, it was tied to some problematic tropes about primitive cultures, and later editions have moved away from this, focusing more on the rage than the culture. What are some ways to navigate these tropes respectfully?
I think this is probably going to be the only time anyone has ever said that battle ragers are a good expression of how to present a culture. But I was just going to point out, like, battle ragers, which are dwarven berserkers, and they've existed since like second edition. But the way those are presented in a lot of places is they're not like a separate tribe of dwarves that live in this area and do whatever. They're actually a separate group of dwarves that are trained differently, that live out on the edges of the mountain, and they're expected to be the first line of defense. And they don't fight in formation like, you know, like the dwarves inside the mountain because they have plenty of room to move. So it's this idea that not everybody in a quote unquote barbarian tribe is a barbarian. That is a very special skill set that certain people have and other people don't.
Jared will correct me on this, on the specifics of this, but I know that in the early editions, barbarians were presented as a class that was absolutely antithetical to any magic at all.
Oh, yeah.
Any magic at all. In fact, one of my buddies has a story he tells of one of those long ago campaigns where he was playing a wizard. And basically the way they got around having him and a barbarian in the same party is he never cast a spell where the barbarian could see it. And the barbarian basically insisted he was just an old warrior that needed to be retrained in how to shoot something. So he trained the wizard how to use a crossbow.
It is one of those things that earlier editions did that kind of drove me a little batty. And that is, they would take something from pop culture and blow it up to be this gigantic thing that it really wasn't. And a lot of that whole barbarians hate magic came from Conan, because Conan didn't trust sorcerers and he didn't like these weird spells that were on things. But if you were an adventurer and you got hit with a spell when you're creeping into a tomb, you wouldn't like magic either. It's not that he hated magic any more than anyone else in the setting. He hated it exactly as much as any other tomb robber that got hit by a curse. It's also very weird because if you look at some cultures, and barbarian is a very loaded word because it implies that some culture is less advanced than another culture,
mm-hmm.
which is a pain. And honestly, I would almost be more comfortable if barbarians were just called berserkers to get away from that entire mindset.
Yes.
But if you look at, for example, where berserkers come from in Norse stories, these were not people that avoided magic. You know, berserkers, like, when they were more powerful, they literally turned into animals. You know, there was nothing about avoiding magic with them.
With that whole concept of, you know, they were originally very against magic, fourth edition implied that barbarians were bound to the magical primal energies that linked them clearly with nature and the supernatural. What are your thoughts on that for the modern barbarian?
I think it works, especially if your barbarian ends up taking some of the more magical subclasses at third level.
Mm-hmm.
Because in fifth edition, there are a lot of barbarian subclasses that are very magical. So having this idea that somehow, like, your soul is connected to the primal energy of nature, and that's where you get all these abilities from, I think it works fine. I do kind of not want that to be the only backstory for a barbarian, though. I do kind of like the idea of the, for lack of a better term, the secular barbarian that just learns how to be angry without the spirits teaching him.
But if you wanted to lean into it, you could have your barbarian be a little bit like a sorcerer with muscles.
Yeah.
You know, they can't control the magic, but they're attached to it so that when they tap into this rage, things happen. Like, there is a wild magic barbarian, in which case random stuff happens.
And I kind of like that idea that somebody could be born with this natural affinity for touching magic, but they never learn how to shape it into spells. That's a very specific way to learn how to use that magic. You may just learn how to hit things really hard and then have pixies appear out of nowhere.
That you could say they lack the strength of character, i.e. the charisma, to be able to control the magic like a sorcerer, or the astute mind, like the intelligence of a wizard, to control it.
But I mean, you can also lean into like the tropes like we talked about with clerics and divine classes, where if you're going to be a storm herald, you might have been initiated into all of these rituals of Thor's priesthood, and that's why you can do this. And again, you didn't learn how to do this with spells, but this is how you learn to connect with Thor.
Yeah. Speaking about supernatural powers, let's take a shift to monks, because regardless of subclass, monks all have key magic. You know, this doesn't really manifest as spells. So how are monks different from the spellcasters in the way that they learn how to harness this power?
So the best explanations I have seen, at least in 5th edition, have been clerics get external power from gods. Wizards get external power from just the natural ambient magic of creation. Druids get this from nature and, you know, drawing that together. Monks get their supernatural abilities from the inside. They're drawing on their own power in order to manifest these supernatural abilities. They're not pulling it from somewhere else and reshaping it. It is coming out of them and then projecting in that manner.
I know with an elemental monk, you could say they're using that internal power to tap into the elemental plane.
I don't know that they ever specifically say this, but I think there's almost something about, like, you're almost using your soul and that, you know, that connection between your soul and your physical body to generate your magic instead of pulling it from somewhere else.
And let's be honest, most of the time that magic is used to punch things better or move to get closer to things to punch them better.
Yeah, and that's actually a thing I was going to bring up. Even though he, as it exists now, feels like a very supernatural thing, depending on what your monk uses it for, you could very easily be, what am I trying to say here, a more mundane martial artist. Not necessarily somebody that's doing, you know, spectacular feats of supernatural defiance of gravity, but somebody that did just learn how to punch people really fast, really hard.
I swear to God, my monk, my halfling monk in Solasta was my biggest damage dealer sometimes.
I know. Now, the problem with that is, if that's going to be your story, you probably are going to have to multi-class out of monk before you start getting the very obviously supernatural abilities that they get later on.
Yeah, and let's have a moment to talk mechanics, because the people who dig into the mechanics of D&D have long held a complaint that the best ranger you can build is a fighter. The best monk you can build is a fighter. Because unfortunately, there's some aspects to the way you can build a fighter that makes them better at unarmed combat than a monk.
What's really funny about that is the key to both of those is actually the fact that the battle master, who is supposed to be a fighter that knows tactics that he can share with other people, also gets to roll that die whenever they use some of these tactics, which just happens to also make them hit harder and shoot harder than other people do too, which suddenly makes them better, even though they're supposed to be making other people better.
Also, there's the, I want to say it's the unarmed combat style. I don't know the specifics. My buddy Chris rants about this all the time. The unarmed combat style gives fighters a better damage die than monks have. I want to say when monks are doing it, they have a D6, but a fighter would have a D8.
I don't know if that's accurate, but I will say that if starting damage die is a problem for monks, it does look like the 2024 rules are going to adjust that, because all of the monk damage die look like they're going to go up by one.
I hope so. I hope they do that.
You can at least punch somebody as hard as you could hit them with a longsword, you know, if that's the case.
Rangers should really have Hunter's Mark as a class ability and not the spell. And I have a feeling when I run again, that's what I'm going to house rule, because it's stupid for it to be a spell.
I'm really curious to see, now that we're going to have multiple versions of semi-somewhat compatible 5e-based games coming out, if some version of the Ranger doesn't do that.
What's your D&D stew going to look like?
Exactly.
When we talked about druids, we talked about how their circles could easily be interpreted as organizations that exist in the game world. Can we do the same thing with monks and their ways?
Yeah, and the funny thing is, there are a couple of monk subclasses that came straight from Forgotten Realms monastic orders. Like the Order of the Sun Soul, which is the monk that gets to shoot lasers out of their fists. That's an order that's devoted to like Lathander and Salune and Suni, I think. It's an interesting combination of gods.
I get Lathander and I get Saluna, because the sun and the moon.
Uh-huh.
And then love.
And we like being pretty and loving people too.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with being pretty.
But I mean, that is an existing order that exists in the Forgotten Realms. In third edition, they had a prestige class that let you do that, but the order existed whether you took that prestige class or not. The other one is the Monks of the Long Death. That's another Forgotten Realms tradition there. Monks that study death to learn how to injure people better.
Wasn't one of the companions in Neverwinter?
Yeah, the dwarf.
Neverwinter Nights?
The dwarf monk. Dwarf.
I didn't like him. He was a jerk.
So, yeah, I don't think it's too hard to look at some of these other subclasses and think that these might be an actual monastery dedicated to that way that teaches monks to use their abilities in that specific way. But it also opens the door for the same thing we talked about with druids, which is, what if you learned at one monastery and you end up adopting a different way? There you already have that idea that, you know, I was trained this way, but I don't think I'm meant to be that.
Yeah, and then of course there's always the drunken monk. So the way of the drunken fist.
Yeah, what's really funny is, even though I've played several monks, trying to remember all of the subclasses that actually exist in 5e versus the ones that I have seen in third party supplements versus me vaguely remembering prestige classes that existed.
Yeah, the only ones I'm familiar with are the elemental druid, because somebody played with him, played that in the Tiamat campaign I was in, and the drunken monk, because that was in the City of Cowls campaign originally. She got in a fight with our Asimar Warlock and ended up leaving. The player had to leave the campaign, but it still ended with drama between the characters.
I have played a Way of Shadows monk, which, by the way, the Way of Shadows monk is a ninja. That's exactly what it is. And I've also played Way of Mercy, which is a really neat one that was in Tasha's. And I love that one because you learn how to harness energies to heal and harm people by channeling your ki. So like you can touch somebody and heal them, or you can slap them and do extra necrotic damage.
So one of them, player doesn't want their monk to be from a distinct philosophical order, but learn separate from an organization through a trainer or by piecing it together on their own. How do you work that into the setting?
This is one of those things where if you look into pop culture, and we just had the creator of this series pass on, which is sad. But like in Dragon Ball, Goku is trained by this old man that just, you know, takes him in and starts showing him how to use all of these abilities. And while it does get into a completely different scale of power, there is a similarity between monks and how people learn martial arts in the Dragon Ball series.
Yeah, I think you can always do the single master that taught you how to do things. I don't think you need to be part of a completely separate order. Actually, what just popped into my head was Kill Bill.
Mm-hmm.
The way they were trained was not an order or anything. It was just they were sent off to learn from this one master.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I mean, that really works with, you know, like if you're picturing your monk was raised to be an assassin, you know, that Way of Shadows thing works really well. And that may not be an order they belong mm-hmm. to. It's just their family is a bunch of assassins and they were teaching you the family trade when they were teaching you all these things.
Finally, let's move to our favorite ne'er-do-wells, rogues. Actually, hold on a moment, because in the current edition, rogues don't have to be criminals. In older editions, they were definitely thieves. In fact, first edition, the class was even called Thief. I hear old school grognards still call the class Thief, even though it is listed in the books as Rogue. So what options are there for where a rogue's skills come from in your setting?
Obviously, you can still be a criminal. That's still on the table.
Obviously.
But I mean, just like with fighters, if you look at some of the abilities that a rogue has, that could very easily also be military training. You were just trained to be a scout instead of a frontline fighter or a formation fighter.
Yeah. I mean, Kizina is an urchin.
Mm-hmm.
That was her background, I think. I can't remember it right now, but I'm pretty sure she was an urchin because she and her sister kind of grew up scrounging as their dad did cons, pretending to be this church man.
Mm-hmm.
You can do a whole lot of things with the different backgrounds.
Oh, yeah. And like in the Forgotten Realms, like in Cormyr, there is actually a society of adventurers. And you could have somebody that literally was just trained to be an adventurer. And a rogue is a really good representation of just, I am learning a little bit of everything so that I can adventure.
Yeah. What about a thieves guild? While it's possible a rogue character may not be tied to a criminal background, their skills may still attract the attention of local organized thieves. So what can you do with these concepts for your characters in your game, regardless of whether your rogue is a criminal or not?
What's really interesting is in a lot of the foundational fiction for D&D, the people that we saw that were thieves or rogues or whatever you want to say they're the inspiration for often did not belong to the Thieves Guild, but there were Thieves Guilds in those stories and they were on the run from them, or they were in direct competition with them. Like, that's a big thing in the Fafhrd and Mauser book. So I think having a Thieves Guild just so that you know what else was in the area and maybe what this person was trying to avoid getting drafted into is an interesting setting detail that you can add in there.
In the previous campaign of the world that City of Cowls is set in, my character was basically somebody who was trained by the Assassin's Guild. And she turned her back on them, so she was hunted by them.
Oh, yeah, and Assassin's Guilds are another fun thing to work into that backstory because they are teaching a similar set of skills for a whole different reason.
Mm-hmm.
I like anything that gives me more organizations to throw into a setting because organizations give your setting more texture, which gives you more things to pull from.
It gives your players more things to bounce off of.
we have yet another pop culture example of this, because Gambit in the X-Men was on the outs with the Assassin's Guild and the Thieves Guild from the New Orleans area, because those were things that existed in the X-Men comics.
You know, Gambit had a way of screwing up his relationships anyway. What about, just as a slight tangent, what about Thieves Cant? It is a language that rogues are allowed to take, but it may not make sense for every rogue.
This is what gets me, because I feel like this is one of those legacy things that got tacked onto rogues. It's not quite as high up there as Rangers should just get Hunter's Mark, but it's in that same territory a few steps down. Because honestly, if you look at a lot of the backgrounds that they came up with, especially like some of the example backgrounds that they put into the playtest packets, they were giving out Thieves' Cant as a language for a lot of criminal flavored backgrounds. And that makes sense to me more than giving it to the rogue class.
Yes, absolutely.
Because not everybody is going to learn how the local thieves communicate with one another.
I believe my cleric in the Rise of Tiamat, Tyranny of the Dragon Queen campaign was a cleric with the smuggler background.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided that A, that meant she could pick locks, and B, she knew some thieves can't.
Yeah.
Because it made sense.
I have zero problem with thieves can't existing. That is a neat story setting element. I just don't know that it should be tied to a class anymore.
Yeah, I agree.
If you're rogues, and we were talking about adventurers and going into, you know, different places to, say, raid tombs, if you have characters that are based, your rogues are more like Lara Croft or Indiana Jones, Thieves' Cant does not make sense for them. But those are both definitely rogue archetypes. I think you could argue that.
Speaking of Indiana Jones and Lara Croft, locked doors and chests along with traps of all kinds are a staple in D&D. And tradition leads us to think that the rogue should always be responsible for dealing with these obstacles. But that can end up with the other characters kind of just sitting there for a long time. How can we make this interesting in the game so we can spotlight the rogue with their special abilities while not leaving the other characters waiting for too long?
I think one of the things that's interesting about that is rogues are only better at spotting and disarming traps if that's where they put their skill specialization in.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's a very traditional thing. You know, it makes sense. Like, I'm really good with thieves tools, so I can do this thing and I get double my proficiency bonus. But you don't have to put it in there. So if your rogue really wants to have another skill that they shine at, they can definitely do that. You could make, you know, your rogue a very eloquent speaker and, you know, double your proficiency bonus on persuasion checks. Speaking of Tomb Raider, I would argue Lara Croft probably doesn't have her double proficiency bonus in specifically picking locks, although she probably doesn't know how to do that.
Also, you can actually get proficiency with thieves tools in other backgrounds.
Oh, yeah.
Zalus had it because she had the smuggler background. I believe Urchin gets it as a default. Criminal obviously gets it. And I want to say Bounty Hunter gets it, because that's what Malcolm is. Malcolm, our warlock, is, and he can also pick locks. It's just that Wonder the Rogue has expertise in it, so he is much better at it than anyone else.
I mean, speaking of Celesta, I don't always take a rogue when I'm playing. I mm-hmm. just make sure somebody can use thieves tools.
Yep.
The other thing that's funny is when I was running the Streets of Avalon game, three of our characters had thieves tools that they are proficient in. The rogue, the cleric, and the fighter all had backgrounds where they were proficient with thieves tools. And we would have situations where, like, Brandon's rogue would sit there and go, "Oh, this lock is too tough for me." And then Eileen's cleric would walk up and, you know, make a roll and click, you know, open the thing right up there.
So while some of the rogue subclasses are just heavily skilled characters, some lean into overtly supernatural abilities, just like we were talking about for some of the other classes.
Mm-hmm.
How do you work these special abilities into the story of the character and the setting?
So first off, when we mentioned all that stuff about being in a magical society and maybe you just learning that on top of your day job, that also applies for Arcane Trickster. And I will go one step further and say, if you have a thieves guild in a country that is highly magical, they probably are going to train some of their people in being arcane tricksters.
I play Kazina, who is a soul knife, and it's just played that she is psionically gifted and was able to channel her psychic energy into creating those knives that she summons from nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually been kind of interesting with that because she doesn't need magic weapons. So it's like, all we get all this magic weapons. It's like, yeah, that's really pretty, but I don't need it. I don't need that weapon.
You're past ninth level now. Do you have, I'm trying to remember what level you get this at. Do you have that ability where you can teleport to where you throw your daggers yet?
Yes.
I love that ability. That is one of my favorite things about the Soul Knight.
I think I've only used it once, but it's still very cool.
Yeah, I love that.
In the City of Cowls campaign, my buddy Chris is playing Anu, who is an arcane trickster. And the concept behind the character was that she was a book thief.
Mm-hmm.
That she is obsessed with books and knowledge and learning. It's just she grew up on the streets, and it was kind of assumed she would be in following her father's footsteps and be part of this thieves guild. But she just loves learning and magic and all of this stuff. And it just, you know, was a natural progression for the character.
I love the Phantom subclass. I like the Phantom better than the Assassin, but the Phantom is not necessarily a good Assassin's Guild type assassin. They're actually kind of creepy serial killer type killer. But when you're thinking about, like, how did my rogue suddenly get these supernatural abilities when my first two levels I didn't have them? Phantom is really easy to explain that, because if you kill somebody and get haunted by their ghost, that helps to unlock this whole idea that, you know, like, now I have to deal with these spirits of people that I've killed. And, you know, I am into much more creepy territory than I thought I would be because I killed this person and their spirit is haunting me.
Last year for Origins, I ran a D&D game for my friend's kids and some of their friends, and I basically made the characters for them. And all I was told from her youngest son was, I want to play a rogue. And I was like, what about this? And I put forth the Phantom, and he was like, oh yeah, that's cool. I want that. Bonus round. In third edition, the Marshal was introduced, and in fourth edition, this morphed into the Warlord. Now, Rob Schwalb, who worked on both 4th edition and 2014 rules, made a third-party 5th edition Warlord, and End Publishing has a Marshal class for their level-up version of the 5e rules. Is there still a place for the Warlord character where they would come into in 5e? You know, or should they just be a subclass for the Fighter?
See, I really like them being their own thing, because I like the duality of the bard boosts you by, you know, singing to you and telling you inspiring stories. The warlord can do something similar by telling you specific tactics that are going to tell you exactly what you need to do in combat. And I like that it does something similar to the bard in a different way.
You know, I would almost say instead of being a fighter subclass, it could be a bard subclass.
There is actually a Kobold Press College of Tactics bard that has some of those abilities where it, like, lets people reposition themselves and,
yeah,
you know, tells people when to take extra attacks and everything. I do still have a weakness for the Warlord as a separate class, though, and I think you can argue that there are some good subclasses you could make out of somebody that is a tactical genius.
I think that's the key with 5th edition and whatever is coming next, is that if it's going to be a separate class, are there enough variations to give it subclass choices?
Exactly, yeah.
We've had the same conversation about the witch, because I had a player playing a witch in my Pathfinder campaign that has held up us translating the characters to 5th edition because there's no good direct translation for the witch.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the same is true for the warlord.
I do like the idea that you have this person that went to, like, a formal military college.
Mm-hmm.
Not just that you were trained by a military unit how to be a good fighter. You actually went to this college where you're studying ancient battles and you're talking about the philosophy of different types of combat. And that's where you get these abilities from. And that really appeals to me. But I also like the people that are just naturally charismatic leaders. Like, for example, if this class existed at the time, I would totally make Hannes from the Dragonlance books into a warlord because that was his whole thing. He was a leader. He was the one that was coordinating everyone.
It's like you're talking about the West Point of the Sword Coast.
Oh, yeah, exactly. That is exactly what I'm picturing here.
No time for rest, you two. Get on with your downtime research.
Now we're going to move into our downtime research segment. Every episode, we're going to look for something related to D&D that we want to pass along to the listeners. It might be products, websites, videos, or podcasts, but it will always be something that we think will enhance your D&D experience.
Over on Prime Video is a documentary called Eye of the Beholder, The Art of Dungeons & Dragons. It's from 2019, so it's a little bit old, but I think it kind of got a little bit lost in the chaos of the last few years. It's an hour and a half long, and it looks at the history of art within Dungeons & Dragons. It is a huge nostalgia hit for anyone who's been playing for, you know, since the 80s or before, or even the 90s. But it's also an insightful look at how art was handled and the people behind it. It basically, this game, there's a lot of pieces that went into making this game what it is and have the lasting power it's had. But one of those pieces is the artwork that has been included in them. And I absolutely loved the documentary. I love there's this part where they talk about TSR in, I think it was the late 70s, early 80s, when they were kind of at their height, and they had this whole other building that was kind of falling down, but it was where all the artists were, and they would play pranks on each other. I want to say Larry Elmore talks about how one day he came in, and he got called away from his desk, and he comes back, and like, his canvas is still there, but all of his tools are not. Slowly looks up and realized they had been put pinned to the ceiling. All of his supplies were up above him on the ceiling.
The other thing that's neat about that special too is there's not an art department that works directly for WotC now. Everybody is like freelancers that they give art or, I mean, they have a person doing art orders in-house, but they don't have this whole stable of artists like TSR did. They literally had these guys just in this building creating art constantly. And it's neat in that special because they do things like where someone would get an assignment for something and they didn't like doing that type of monster or whatever, so they would trade it with somebody else.
Also, there's a little bit in there about the original artwork from, I believe it's the first edition Player's Handbook, that is definitely worth watching the documentary for.
Oh, yeah. What I wanted to bring up is Tales of the Valiant is getting a starter set, but it is not being made by Kobold Press. Steamforge Games, who primarily make board games, but they also did the Dark Souls RPG, they're the ones producing the box set. And I suspect this is because box sets have components that aren't books, and they're probably better handled by a company that's used to doing board game stuff. But it's interesting to me because this is the second RPG starter set that I've seen in the last few months that is being made by a company other than the company that produces the game. And the other one is the Marvel Multiverse starter set, which is being made by CMON, the M-O-N, cool mini or not. I don't know how people pronounce that abbreviation. I just read it all the time. But it's really interesting that some of these RPG companies are now outsourcing something that kind of felt like a thing that you would just naturally do as part of your line to someone else now.
Yeah, and I think if they're definitely including, you know, like minis or other pieces or cards, it's definitely worth bringing in somebody who's a little bit more of an expert at that.
Yeah, if nothing else, they might just have better sources for getting things like dice or, you know, things like that. So, or just knowing somebody that can make a sturdy box. I mean, that's actually been a thing that some RPG companies struggle with, finding somebody that can make a box that isn't going to collapse on them.
Yeah, as I look over at my Force and Destiny box, which is so squishy.
That's weird because Fantasy Flight does make board games and things like that, and they still made really terrible boxes for all those starter sets.
Heading on out of here, we're happily part of the Misdirected Mark Productions Network, so we wanted to give a shout out to another MMP show. If you're enjoying our show, also consider checking out
The Gnomecast. Several gnomes from Gnomes 2 get together to talk about gaming topics and themselves in an effort to entertain you and avoid being thrown in the stew. Also, we just did our 50th anniversary Gnomecast. Gnomecast hasn't been around for 50 years. D&D has been around for 50 years. But a bunch of us got together and talked about what D&D has kind of meant for them. And it's a really neat episode. I loved hearing everybody else's stories. So you should probably listen to that.
Yeah, it's I'm really proud of that episode. And I think it's definitely worth listening to. It would have been the episode that dropped on March 13th. We've used up all of our resources, so I think it's time for a long rest. I hope this adventure was rewarding for you, and we hope you'll go exploring with us when we start our next adventure.